Welcome to Give Theory a Chance. In this episode, we are joined by Alicia M. Walker, Associate Professor of Sociology at Missouri State, and Arielle Cooperberg, Associate Professor of Sociology at the University of Maryland, Baltimore County. Alicia and Arielle discuss their co-authored book, Bound by BDSM, Unexpected Lessons in Building a Happier Life, reflect on some of the methodological and writing choices they made along the way, and share some life lessons from the study. Thanks for joining us today, Alicia and Arielle.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
So to get going, I'm wondering if you could just talk about how you found this particular topic, and then along with finding the topic of BDSM, how did you decide that would be something worthy of investing so much time researching?
So I had about six different students over the course of about 9 months independently come to me and say, have you thought about studying BDSM? And the first three, I was like, no, I haven't. But the fourth one, I started thinking, maybe I should start thinking about it. And so I approached Arielle. I like working with Arielle. We had worked together for a few years, I think, prior to this project. And I said, hey, you know, would you want to do this study with me? And thankfully that she did. And we designed a survey and we designed interview questions together and figured out where to recruit. And I think we sort of thought it was going to be kind of on the smaller side of projects. And then it just sort of grew into this is actually the largest study of BDSM practitioners to date.
Was this something that you had been reading about, a topic that, or that you assigned articles about in your classes before, or it really was you teach things related to sexuality, students had this idea, and then you started from scratch?
I still don't actually bring this up. I teach in a pretty conservative place. I think they tolerate my shenanigans as much as, you know, they're probably going to. I really shouldn't push it any further than I have. So I don't ever talk about kink or BDSM in my classes, but I do teach sexuality. And so I think that's why folks were approaching me. But I think Arielle teaches about it.
Yeah, I teach about it now, but at the time we had started this project, I had not taught a sexuality class before. But I had done several projects on kind of more mainstream sexuality projects. And I did a project with Alicia on sexual identity. And I kind of like to learn new things with each research project I do. So I saw this as a way to kind of branch out into a new area of research. To me, it's like, I'm not the kind of person who could write 30 articles on the same topic usually, because it just gets boring to me. Yeah. So I'm like, oh, this is like, it's something I encountered in real life. You know, I had done sexuality research. So I think Alicia has also had this experience of people come up to you, like your confessional, to tell you all about, you know, various sexual practices they do that most people might be judgmental about. So I had come across a few people who had heard I did sex research and then started telling me about their BDSM experiences. And I had some friends who were in the BDSM community. So I thought it would be an interesting way to kind of, learn about a new topic. But yeah, I teach a sexuality class now, and I do have a day where we talk about BDSM and kink and other, I pair it with stuff on other sexual communities. And I'm actually, I assigned this book we have a book club in my class where different groups read different books. So one of the groups is reading this book. So we'll see what they think about it.
It's also fun to see the different models of how we find our research projects where, like you were saying, there can be an academic who spends their whole career reading three chapters of Marx and trying to figure out exactly what's going on there. Or you can just find different topics that excite you and then engage like you did in the rigorous research around it.
Yeah, I think there was a sociology, I want to say it was Herbert Gans, who wrote about how there are two types of sociologists in his view. One was like the one who goes very deep into one topic, and one is someone who goes into like a lot of different subfields. And I think he saw himself as one of the types who are in a lot of different subfields. But then you could kind of have cross-pollination between the different subfields. So some of the stuff we talked about in this book was also some of the theory I was looking at when I was doing research on stay-at-home dads, which is more of like a family and work topic. But ideas about stigmatization and masculinity kind of went across both projects.
So you mentioned before, I think, Alicia, you started to say that you came up with, you designed a survey, which is one of the largest surveys ever on this topic. And then you also had some interviews. How did you come up with your methodological approach? And did you think about any other approaches to this, or the subject matter kind of guided you this way?
Yeah, actually, both components are the largest that's ever been conducted so far. Well, I'm quantitative and I can
Qualitative.
I'm qualitative. I'm not quantitative at all. Don't ask me to count.
Feel free to change your identity at this point.
Yeah, let me just so you know, I just picked up doing stats, Ariel. I'm qualitative. There we go. And I specialize in both offering participants a choice in the kind of interviews that they do, phone or email. And I'm sort of an early pioneer, I guess, of email interviewing, which works really, really well when you're doing sexuality research, especially around closeted behavior, which is something I also specialize in. And so and Ariel, of course, is an amazing statistician and demographer by training. And so it just seemed like the natural thing to do that we would have a survey component and an interview component. And I pretty much approach everything I do from a grounded theories perspective. I don't go in with any sort of idea of what I think is happening or what I think is going to find, what I'm going to find. I just let the data tell me what's going on. And so all of that guided our decision making.
Yeah. And I think for me, so Alicia mentioned that I'm a statistician, but after I got tenure, which was right around when we were starting this project, I also wanted to get more involved with survey research and collecting my own data. And this was actually one of the first big survey data collection projects I worked on. And now I've worked on several of them. Mm-hmm. But I also saw this as a way to like kind of get more experience with I've crunched a bunch of other people's surveys. Now I could go and design my own and ask the questions I want to ask, which was cool.
You know, I actually haven't even asked, which is probably the question I should have started with. What is BDSM? But that also relates to this question of how did you find people to fill out the survey or to respond to the interviews, whether it was email or phone?
Yeah. So BDSM stands for bondage. B is for bondage, D is for domination and discipline, S is for sadism and submission, and M is for masochism. So it's a bunch of different practices ranging from, pain to having kind of like power exchanges to tying people up that are usually paired with sexual activity, but not always. Not everybody has sex during BDSM encounters. As to how we found people, so we went to a wide variety of different places. Alicia at first had some of her students posting flyers in like sex toy shops in person. She, at the time, Craigslist Personals still existed. So we went and found people in different cities posting about BDSM and then like sent them invitations. But we also, the major place that our research came from was Reddit. We posted on two subreddits after we got permission, which was like a whole thing in and of itself. But we were able to post on our BDSM and our sex. And we got over 1,500 responses from those two places alone. So something like over 2/3 of our sample is from Reddit. We also were able to post on FetLife, which is kind of like Facebook for people who are into fetishes, different like sexual fetishes. And we posted on a few Facebook groups. So we kind of went to every social media website we could find that was related to BDSM and sent out the invitation. And we were lucky that the thread kind of went viral on Reddit a little bit. So it got a lot of views and we got, ultimately, we got over 2,400 responses to our survey, and Alicia,
which is a huge amount. Like,
yeah,
could you have imagined that many when you started? What was your goal response?
I was like 300 would probably be enough to like run some numbers. Yeah, no, I didn't expect it to be that. I wasn't exactly sure what to expect. As I said, this was one of the first times I had ever collected my own survey data. I definitely didn't expect this many responses, or that we would end up being the largest study on BDSM, which we went and tried. Someone was like, you are the largest. And we like went and looked around. We're like, huh, we are, like, crazy.
When you were posting that you were conducting a study, did you specify that you were interested in people who made BDSM part of their identity? Or was it more specifically, if you engage in any of these practices associated with BDSM, we're interested?
So we asked specifically for BDSM practitioners. So people, okay. It was people who identified as a BDSM practitioner. And yeah, there's actually like a much, if you look at BDSM practices in general, a lot of people engage in some practices that would be considered BDSM, like spanking is super common. A lot of people will experiment with like tying someone up or role play or something like that, but it doesn't get to the point where they consider themselves a practitioner. So we were more interested in the people who had gotten to the point where they kind of identify as a BDSM practitioner.
It's interesting to think about how rapidly there's been a shift. And actually, you can tell me if my impression of this is wrong, but within the public consciousness of BDSM practices, where I didn't even think initially to be like, define this term. And if I were interviewing you 10 years ago, I feel like I would have been more likely to ask that question. I teach a sociology of the body class, and we have a few chapters where we talk about different type of sexual practice and kink and identity. And even in the 5 years, the way students respond to those chapters seems very different. And I don't think it's just because I've been teaching it longer. It seems like students are more primed to be like, yeah, we don't see this as anything out of the ordinary.
I think part of that was 50 Shades of Grey, which was super popular last decade, where there was like some books came out and then there was like a series of movies that were also very popular. So I think that just put it in the public consciousness a lot more. But I think the internet also, this generation of students was raised with the internet and always had information at their fingertips. I could tell you when I started teaching, people didn't know what like trans people were. They had never heard of trans people. And I was explaining that to my students now, and they were like, what? How could you like not know that? But that wasn't that long ago. That was like 15 years ago. Nobody had any idea, except if you were a gender studies professor or queer and knew people personally.
So with a project like this, you could approach it from so many different directions in terms of what theory you're drawing on. And I'm curious, one of the things that I really appreciate about the book is that you don't spend a lot of time saying, this is my chapter, this is my Judith Butler chapter, or this is my Anthony Giddens chapter, or now I'm going to use like affect theory or something. Behind the scenes, were there particular theories that you were inspired by or you found useful as you were trying to make sense of your what you were finding?
Definitely, you know, the Goffman's idea of front stage, backstage, for sure, and definitely stigma. That was really key to what a lot of people were talking to us about. We did an early paper from this data set where we used constructionist versus like essentialist, as we're looking at how people, the pathways people took to like get into BDSM. And so that came up a lot in that discussion. So it sort of depends on like what aspects we're looking at. We have a number of articles planned as well as the book. And so that's the thing about BDSM. There's so much going on. There's so many identities, so many practices, so many different ways of doing it. You know, people are in 24/7 power dynamics versus people are just going to play parties versus, you know. And so depending on what you're looking at, really, you're going to need a different theory to think about it and to talk about it, honestly.
I think we also drew a lot on hegemonic masculinity theory when we were looking at ideas about gender and how people use BDSM as a way to kind of play with gender ideas. And we talked a little bit about sexual scripting theory. So, yeah, I'm more an inductive way of like looking at the data first and being like, what theory actually explains what I'm finding here? So we tend to draw like on a bunch of different theories, like social norm theory. And yeah,
I have some follow-ups. I'm actually, it translates really well into just thinking first, what are the findings that you had? Because you've kind of touched on a little bit of that along the way, thinking about how it relates to things like gender identity, how people are performing these different scripts. So what are some of the findings that stuck out the most to you?
I think the big finding for me. In fact, for a long time, I was like, Ariel, I don't know what this book is about. I don't know what this data is about. Part of the reason we have such a huge sample is that it was really difficult to tell that I had reached saturation because it was so many different identities, so many different experiences. And the one thing that everybody in the entire data set had in common, at least on the interview side, was that they were wildly happy, which may not sound like, okay, so what? But I've interviewed lots of them, and I've never had a sample besides this one where every single person I talked to explicitly discussed how happy they were.
Was that a question you were asking, or that just came up
No.
through talking about? Okay.
No, I think we had a survey question about happiness, but there was not any, there were no interview questions specifically about that. So no, it just came up by itself, which is also like kind of interesting.
And it wasn't happy in terms of saying, I'm happy about my sex life or about my erotic experiences. It was, I'm happy. Which is a big claim.
Hey, that is a huge claim, yeah. And so for to have every single person say, you know, ever since I found BDSM, I'm like happy. My life is so much better. It's like greatly improved my life, et cetera, et cetera. That's pretty interesting. And so that became the focus of the book because that is so unusual. So for me, that's the biggest overall finding for sure. And then we started looking at, okay, so why are all these people happy? Because it's not just that they're having great sex. I've interviewed lots of people who are having great sex that did not come up explicitly in their interviews, how happy they were. And so we started looking at sort of what are the pieces of BDSM culture? What kind of structures exist that are lending itself to all of this happiness? And so that became the focus of the book. And that's really, I think, the biggest and most interesting takeaway is what we can learn from BDSM folks without participating in BDSM, because that's not everyone is not interested in doing that. And if that's not something that you're interested in, doing BDSM is not going to make you happy. But what can we take from the structures that BDSM provides that can make folks happier?
Like, so some of the things we found that BDSM gave people was a sense of identity, that they had a sense of authenticity, that they had, you know, when they were able to disclose their identity to other people, it gave them a source of community. Yeah. And it also, that we had a whole chapter on gender and how it also allowed people to kind of explore aspects of their sexuality that may not align with ideas about gender and sexuality, like that men should be dominant, but that here's a place where men could explore like submissive sides of sexuality. So yeah, we had like a kind of a lot of sub findings within that broad finding, but our main finding was about BDSM kind of providing this structure that gives people different things that kind of contribute to happiness.
Did people talk about how that shaped their identity outside of when they were engaged as a BDSM practitioner? And did it shape their identity in other areas of their life? Or was more that now they could have this space or practice to return to or seek out or know was there while they're also doing other things in life?
When you say that, do you mean BDSM or the happiness?
Yeah. Sorry. That might've been confusing. I was curious because thinking about how they're expressing happiness, not just as a BDSM practitioner, but saying I'm generally a happy person.
Gotcha.
And so I was wondering if they talk about how they can take, they themselves can take lessons they've learned in this space into other areas of their life. Or was it more that, well, no matter what's happening in my life, I have this place that I can retreat to or look forward to?
I think it's all those things. So folks talked about how a lot of people said, like, I thought I was a good communicator, and then I got involved in BDSM, and that really improved my communication style. And then people talked about how finding BDSM was like coming home. You know, it was a space where I'm fully accepted, and I'm not just accepted, like I'm tolerated, I'm accepted and I'm celebrated. Like, I have this whole group of people who are like, I think that the way you are is terrific and wonderful, and it complements how I am. And people talked about how having that space and having those practices in that community improved how confident they felt in other spaces. A lot of people talked about the increase in confidence that they had and just feeling more satisfied overall with their life and with their relationships.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about how the way you're describing it, how important it is to have a space where you can express something or make a claim about your identity and then have it feel like you're being seen or feel like that's validated by other people saying, we also see you in that way and respond to you in the appropriate manner based on what you're claiming.
Oh yeah, for sure. For sure. And you think about how many people don't have that, don't have a space anywhere where they, I mean, maybe people do see them and maybe people do celebrate them, but they don't necessarily feel that.
Yeah, one of the things that really interested me when reading the book was how well people are able to articulate what the site meant to them. And seemingly, and this goes along with your response rate and how it surprised you, how eager people were to tell their story about this is this thing that I'm doing and this is why it actually matters. And almost, it seemed like they're almost selling it to you as the person who would listen to them talk about it.
They were selling it to me. I had lots of invitations from folks, very gracious invitations to come observe, to come participate. I had to say, I don't have IRB approval for that, but you know, I appreciate you thinking of me. And that's something that's kind of interesting too, right? You have all these people that are like, hey, I found this thing that like so greatly improves my life. I want to share this with you. I want you to see what this is like too. You could have this, of course, you know, like I said, if you're not interested in BDSM, doing it is actually not going to increase your happiness. It's not going to do anything for you except probably make you uncomfortable. But their excitement and their enthusiasm and their love for it was really palpable in those interviews and definitely contagious. And they very much were offering to, you know, be my guide, be my realtor to the space if that was something that I was interested in, you know, which is, that's nice. That's a form of caring, you know.
I think the degree to which it can be stigmatized in society and that they do engage in having to do kind of identity management of only telling certain people or making sure people are cool before they kind of come out to them with their BDSM identity can make it like a relief and like a catharsis to have an interview about it. And I think there's a lot of topics that when you interview people about, it could be kind of like therapeutic for them to be able to talk about something that does tend to be very judged. And then you are there as like a non-judgmental person who wants to hear their story. I think interviewees can get something out of that too, right?
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
It actually reminded me a lot of, so I've done research on people who join mixed martial arts gyms and how they form community through that experience, which also relates to gender norms and intimate connections and pain. And I've co-authored with someone who researches people who convert to Eastern Orthodox religion later in life. And then it's funny, as I was reading this, I was having flashbacks to that research because there was a similar thing where people were saying, hey, this matters to me. And then taking that next step of saying, not only does this matter to me, let me walk you through it. And you should consider this because it will potentially make you a better or happier person also. And which seems like a real, in terms of how we can generalize out or extend the research, is telling us something about subcultures where you find a sense of belonging for whatever reason. How did what you find relate to some of the previous writing on the topic?
I think a lot of previous research on BDSM that we looked at was more like psychology. Do they have a mental illness? Or like, were they like, did they have childhood abuse or something? Like I haven't seen a ton of BDSM research from a sociological perspective. It seems more about like, let's try to prove they're mentally ill or not mentally ill or something like that. And yeah, that wasn't even like a question we really engaged with at all. Like, that's not what we're interested in.
Our research just kind of went in a very different direction than what existed before. But what literature did overlap with the various different pieces of what we found seemed to line up. At least what little there was that had something to do with something we found seemed to line up. Yeah.
I'm curious about the approach you took to actually writing the book. And I've mentioned before how one of the things I enjoyed about it is that I could sit down and just enjoy reading it. It wasn't just a chore to get through, which is nice. And it's something that I could hand to a student or someone who's interested in the topic, but not necessarily an academic, and they would also be able to pick it up and enjoy reading it. How did you decide to take this approach to writing it? And I know that's kind of a vague question, but even the title of it gives away that you had a goal of saying, hey, the second part of the title is Unexpected Lessons for Building a Happier Life. That's not necessarily the most academic title, and you're signaling someone else might want to pick this up. When you started the project, did you know that would be one of your goals, or did you realize once you were gathering data, you're like, hey, this is something that we could share to a broader audience? I'm kind of just curious how you approached it.
So as the study grew, I remember saying to Ariel, we have enough data, we could probably write a book. And Ariel was like, no, I don't. Well, and you didn't really like write books at the time. So she was like, no, I'm not.
Yeah, this is my first book. Like,
yeah. So I was like, oh, that's fine. And then the project got so big and it took so long. And then we wrote one article and we still had so much data. And I was just like, oh my goodness, I don't know what we're going to do with this. And I was actually focused on another study that I had collected data on at the same time. And it was actually our editor who approached me, probably because I had already written a book, at a conference, and said, I think you should write a book about this BDSM research. And I originally said, no, I don't want to do that. And I don't think that Ariel wants to do that. And then Ariel was at the conference, and remember I ran into you and I was like, oh, I just met with this woman. She wants us to write a BDSM book. But, and I'm about to say, I told her we didn't want to do it. And Ariel's like, yeah.
So, I think
no, we did not start this project. None of this was planned at all. And then even once we said, okay, we'll write a book, then when we start sitting down and like sifting through the data, it was like, I don't even know like what we have here. I don't even know what this is. And so in my previous books that I've written, the more I wrote, the more clear it was to me that I could write the book. And with this book, it was completely the opposite experience. I would complain to Ariel all the time. I was like, the more I write, the less sure I am that I can write this book. And I'm getting nervous. And I don't know why we said we were going to do this. And, you know, the sky is falling and whatever. And Ariel was how she always is, which is like, it's fine. It's all going to be fine, you know. And she was right. It was all fine. So I was.
Oh, I thought you were going to reveal that it wasn't now.
No.
And now I have to tell her that none of it worked and I'm unhappy with this.
No. She was right. It was fine. But yeah, I think it was just through the process of, and we wrote lots of drafts. Like the book is so different from the early drafts. I mean, some of these chapters we have like draft 15, you know, I mean, it was like, it took us a while to really get to like, okay, this is what this book is about. And this is how we're going to try to tell the story. And, but I think we knew pretty early we wanted to write a not academic book, right? I don't think I'm misremembering that. I think that that's true, that we wanted to write for like a general audience. So that part of the decision-making was absolutely intentional, but it didn't come until way after the data collection had already happened.
Yeah, from my perspective, I never thought of myself as a book writer. I turned my dissertation into like 3 articles and never thought I would write a book. But we had like a lot of half-started papers on pretty general topics when this editor approached us. And just an overwhelming, we had like a ton of data and there was so many things you could do with this data. And I think when Alicia came to me, I was like, oh, well, it might be easier to just like put it off. Like, it'll be easier to just write a book, right? I don't know if that turned out to actually be easier, but we did go through it first, like the idea of like happiness being our story. I think we first sent in a proposal and then got kind of like a revise and resubmit on the proposal. And it was the second time around that we kind of came to this, like, I think it was over winter break. I remember it being like Christmas time or something. And like all in a flash, like it all came to us and we were like, okay, here's the metaphor and here's the runes. And like, this all makes sense.
Wait, for people who are listening, haven't read the book, because that's a really key part that I was actually going to ask a follow-up about. Can you talk about the metaphor in the rooms? Because one of the key things in the book is that idea of home and all the rooms and foundation and all that. So can you explain that a little bit?
That is 100% Ariel. That is her idea. And that would never, no, it's true. And it's an amazing idea and it would never have occurred to me. So she needs to tell you, because I would not have come up with that. Ever.
Yeah, no, we're just, I mean, we talk about BDSM as this structure. And so I think that's, we were talking about it as a structure, and that's where the idea of it, like a house came to me. But it's like a home. A home has several different rooms and each room kind of fulfills different needs. So your kitchen is where you eat, you know, there's the bedroom to sleep in and stuff like that, right? So our metaphor became that like, BDSM provides these kind of different things, but then it binds them together into this structure that gives you all these different things that humans, that help humans like thrive and be happy. And another part of that metaphor is that your house doesn't always have to look the same. It doesn't have to be BDSM that is tying these ideas together. You could get community from other places, definitely. You could get a sense of identity from other places. So we talk about like identity is like the bedroom of the home. Community is like the living room of the home. We talk about creativity as kind of like the kitchen of the home, where BDSM allows people to be creative and try out all these different things and kind of exercise their creativity and wear different costumes and role play. We talk about, I'm like, what are some of the other rooms? Dining room is like communication, and how BDSM really like kind of teaches these communication skills and emphasizes very honest and open communication. Kind of like in the dining room, that the focus is on like sitting around a table and face to face and communicating with each other while you're maybe having family meals. And then the last room is the basement. And that's where we talk about BDSM being a way to kind of explore different parts of your desires that may not go along with what society, like the things you don't want to have in your living room, the things you kind of tuck away in your basement. But that's our chapter about gender and how BDSM allows people to kind of explore aspects of gender that don't align with mainstream ideas about what you should do if you're a specific gender.
So related to writing, but also methodology and to the room metaphor, as we talked about before, people were very open and eager to share stories. And so this book is packed full of stories where people talk about the BDSM practices that they engage in and really walk you through them in a very detailed manner. How did you decide what stories and what level of detail to include? And were there stories that you said, maybe we should not include this in the book?
That was very challenging. These were really detailed interview transcripts. These are some of the longest interviews I have ever conducted. The phone interviews, most of them I had, because I was using tapes, cassette tapes, because I'm very old school and I've lost some stuff on digital files before. And I would have to like change the tape. You know, some people have like 2 and 3 tapes, or we'd have to stop for the day, pick it up another day, et cetera. Because people were telling me so many stories. And so it was difficult to like wade through those stories. And there were lots of really interesting stories that definitely did not make the book. Sometimes they just didn't make the book because we already have a story that sort of fulfills the same purpose or illustrates the same point.
And yeah, so you have to choose the most representative one or something.
Yeah. But there were some stories that we specifically left out of the book. There were some women who talked about some experiences of being gang raped at some play parties with witnesses and the whole nine yards, so like an audience to your rape. And so they had, after the interviews, contacted me and said, I want you to tell that that happened, but I don't want you to share the specifics of my story, which we were totally happy to, you know, to honor those requests. That was fine.
Yeah. And I mean, it's a difficult decision to know what to include and what not to include, because you're writing this both to people within the scene. And then also for some people, this will be their first exposure to the scene.
Yes.
Did you feel like you had, did you think about who the audience was, and did that shape the way you felt about the responsibility of what you put in these pages?
I very much wanted to be sure that we were representing everybody with dignity and authenticity. I wanted to be very true to what people had shared with me, but also this is already a really stigmatized group. So, you know, I don't want to paint them stigmatized and just like add to that. You know what I'm saying? I don't want somebody to walk away from the book and their takeaway be like, oh, these people are, you know, into weird stuff or whatever. And so that definitely, especially in the early drafts, I think I withheld a lot of stories because of my concern about that. And I have a cousin that I usually let read my early drafts and let him weigh in. I figure if he can understand what I'm saying, then, you know, I'm probably on the right track. And his early feedback was, where is all of the sex? Where is all of the discussions of, you know, sex? I thought this was a book about BDSM. Like, what have you done with all that? I know you must have it. And I was like, well, I've been, you know, kind of holding that back. I didn't want to make it like too salacious or whatever. And he was like, listen, if I'm picking up a book about BDSM, that stuff better be in there.
And those were the stories that the respondents told you all. It wasn't like you were telling them to tell. They were eager to tell you those stories also.
Oh, listen, typically when I'm talking to people, they're not necessarily telling me about their sexual escapades. They're more telling me about how their sexual practice impact their lives. This was the most graphic set of interviews I have ever done. And every single person, multiple stories in great detail and explicit detail about what they were doing. And so I really was doing us a disservice by kind of holding those back. But it really came out of my desire to, I don't want to make this so sensationalized. I don't want to, you know, I don't want to do a disservice to the community, basically. And then when we put them in, the editor was like, oh, I'm so glad you put these in. So I'm thankful. Thank you, Cousin Dustin, for your feedback. So,
was it difficult to figure out? So that's in love in terms of the detail, but in terms of the more positive experiences of BDSM, or then as you pointed out, you also had some cases where horrific things have happened. How did you figure out how to balance those two sides of the story? Or maybe not sides, but different types of experiences within the scene would be a better way to say it.
Other than the five women that I mentioned, the stories were overall overwhelmingly positive. We even had a question where we asked about play goes wrong, you know, and like whose fault is that when play goes wrong? And everybody had a story about play going wrong, but they were all, whose fault do you think it was? So interesting that nobody was pointing the finger. They're like, oh, I think it's all parties involved because everybody has to communicate and et cetera, et cetera. So even those stories were, you know, just not really horrific. We didn't really have any horrific stories of like play gone wrong per se. So that wasn't a tough decision because the stories were overwhelmingly positive.
We do have a section of the chapter in the communication chapter where we talk about when communication goes wrong, when play goes wrong. We do have a few statistics that we collected on things like rates of sexual assaults within BDSM encounters. So it's in the book. It's not like the focus of the book, but we definitely cover that topic.
Yeah, we tried to present a very accurate picture and we didn't shy away from like, oh, well, we're going to withhold this because that would make folks look bad. So,
yeah. Okay. So you've definitely done this already, but what lessons can be taken from your research that people can apply to their own lives? And again, this is my motivation to have you on because I think you do such a good job with this in the book. And it's something as academics, we often forget the importance of reminding people, hey, you've just read about this research project, but what do you do with it now? And so talking about the different rooms, talking about some of the lessons about happiness, the lessons are clearly there. I'm wondering if you each could share one of the lessons that people could walk away with.
I think the biggest lesson is be absolutely unapologetic in your authenticity. Be honest with yourself about who you are and what you want so that you can be honest with other people and ask for what you want loudly and don't compromise, you know, ask for what you want and keep seeking until you get what you want. You know, in BDSM, people have these really upfront conversations about like, hey, I really want X, Y, and Z to happen. And the other person is either like, yeah, I'm into that and I can do that, or that's not my bag, and nobody gets upset or their feelings hurt or resentful. And that's so antithetical to how the vanilla world runs, especially in our romantic relationships. You know, we fall in love with people and we just think that it's all going to work itself out, especially the sex piece. And so very often it doesn't. And we take it personally when folks don't want the same things that we want or don't want them as often. And how much healthier would our relationships be if we had those upfront conversations like, hey, this is what I need. This is what I want. Either you can provide it or you can't. Either I can provide what you need or I can't. And so, yeah, I think just being super fully honest with yourself and other people and asking for what you want and not compromising about what you want, I think is a big takeaway in terms of happiness.
And not just in romantic or sexual relationships. As you're saying that, I was thinking about your coworkers or even your, as a professor in a class, having students say, here's the things that I really would like you to provide. Yeah. And you being able to say, well, here's what I can do and what I can't do. I mean, that's a really useful process.
It really is.
Ariel, did you have a lesson to be taken?
Yeah, I'd say the biggest lesson for me as I was writing this was kind of finding your people and finding people who you could truly be yourself around and who accept you and celebrate you. And it doesn't necessarily, not everybody is going to be your person, right? You don't have to, like, I mean, one thing we found is people were kind of selective in who they told about their BDSM identity. So you could be selective in who you open up to, but to find people who you're able to open up to. And I also, we talk about how people kind of form friendships and going back to these BDSM community places over and over again leads to friendships. And I was writing about this as I was moving states for the first time in 15 years, as I'm like in my mid 40s and trying to think about like how to form community in a new state where I knew one person who lived here before I moved here. So the idea of like showing up and like coming back over and over again, I think was a useful one for me, personally.
I think that's a perfect way to wrap up the conversation. I appreciate you both taking the time. This was a lot of fun to talk through.
No, absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Appreciation goes to Jeffrey Gilbert for providing theme music, SUNY Brockport for providing financial support, and most importantly, on behalf of me, Kyle Green, thank you for giving Theory a chance.